You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
Hey, what's up, everyone? I'm Matt Migaki, the vocalist of Cryptopsy and the host of the Vox and Hops Metal Podcast, where I sit down with fellow metal musicians. We talk all about their lives and music while sharing killer craft beers. If you've ever wanted to sneak backstage and share a beer with one of your favorite musicians, well, Vox and Hops is the podcast for you. This week on the podcast, I had an amazing conversation with Morgan Lander and SJ Jones about Kitty Pig. There is this episode and over 450 other ones to help you enjoy life, metal, and craft beer. So what are you waiting for? It's time to become a Vox and Hops head. Cheers!
Hey, hey, welcome to another very special episode of Flying Call. If you missed it over the weekend, you may be wondering why I'm coming at you a day early. Well, I'm very stoked to announce that starting today, the show is switching over to a 2-1-2 schedule. I'll be alternating weekly between releasing two episodes on Tuesday and Thursday, and one episode on Wednesday. That means I'll be able to share more great conversations with more amazingly talented people. And one of those people is Casey Cavalier. Chances are you're most familiar with him as one of the guitarists in the Wonder Years. But you may or may not know that he also works behind the board as a producer at True Level Studio. Adapting over the last year, a major part of his work has been done virtually with one-on-one artist development sessions, focusing on songwriting, the business side of music, and more. In this conversation, we discussed what he enjoys so much about this process, his songwriting and production philosophies, and of course, some Wonder Years talk to boot. We literally just recorded this last night, but I found the content extremely valuable and wanted to share it as soon as possible, so please enjoy. One of the things it seems that you're kind of like most excited about lately from the Q&As you've been doing is the kind of coaching that you do through True Level Studio. And I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit more about that and kind of what you enjoy so much about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So you mentioned True Level Studio. So that's been a space that I've worked out of doing some production work, just writing, for Wonder Years and, it was just kind of born out of a partnership of me and two other guys that needed a collective space to do a lot of the post-production stuff and ultimately just to store a ton of gear that was piling up in lockups and basements and houses all over the place. So we came together and found a spot. It's like right across the bridge in Blackwood, New Jersey. And more or less, started working with local bands, different clients, everything from mixing, mastering, writing, producing. And then, so obviously it's no surprise. Last year, the world kind of turned upside down. And I think when that happened, you saw across the entire industry, really a lot of people take stock of, what they were really doing, what they wanted to do, what they could still do in the meantime. If you're someone like us, in a band that up until that point it was used to spending a lot of time on the road and playing shows and interacting with real live human beings in the same room. So that wasn't an option. I threw myself a little bit more into finding shelter and solace in the studio. If I'm gonna quarantine, at least I could do it there safely and not bother anybody and try to be creative. But one of the things that came out of I guess a lot of that clarity and realizing the things that we had been doing and how we've been utilizing that space and the relationship between my two other partners at the studio was that a lot of the bands that we had been working with would come in. We go through the pre-production process, the whole phase of making a record, a song, or whatever role they were asking us to handle, be it just mix, master, whatever, and started realizing that there was a trend that it would never really just stop with, okay, there's the track, cool, we love it, see you later. Felt like a lot of specifically younger bands, and or a lot of younger solo artists were at a real interesting crossroads where they were making music and leaving the studio, having learned a lot, felt like they grew a lot, but were unsure what to do with that, right? So they had a record and they were like, great, like, I know that you can, you know, put it on Bandcamp. I know that you can get an account and get it up on Spotify, but like, what about everything else? Or, you know, and so I'd say, okay, well, the next time you come in, or that, you know, the next session we have on the books, let's just take an hour afterwards and sit down and kind of chat about everything non-recording related, right? Because there's a whole lot beyond that, right? That's super important. And started doing that, started just trying to give any advice I could from my experience with Wonder Years and what our career has taught me, and what the people that I know, friends of mine, you know, that are extremely talented and that I've had the privilege of interacting with throughout the years, what I've learned from them, right? And trying to pass that along in whatever relevance it might be to the point that they were at, you know, especially a lot of them at like a stage where they were just kind of taking off, but still doing it all themselves and independently, and not having a ton of guidance or direction in terms of pivoting one way versus the other and things like that. And you know, that ended up seeming as though it was really valuable to a number of those artists. And when the pandemic hit, everybody obviously dissolved into a Zoom call world with family, friends, and telecommuting and work and everything. And I realized that that was one of the things that we could still do, that I could still do. And I kind of took a look and said, well, let me maybe pivot a little bit more towards that, focusing on that. Well, I can't have bands in the studio or everything that we had on the books for that year in between Wonder Years related stuff, you know, had kind of had to be pushed back and moved around. And that's kind of how the coaching sessions came about, as an extension of what I had already kind of been doing or trying to do, you know, with the bands that had come to us in the studio, you know, in a studio capacity initially. And yeah, it's been awesome. Realizing, I think a lot of the reason and drive behind that, and why I think now, even just a year later, I'm not only still doing it, but, you know, actively kind of engaging and trying to figure out even more ways to do it, and ways to do it better, and other things that can be covered, I think is because I took a look back at, you know, at my life when I was a kid, and realized just how important some of the mentors were for me, actually being able to be here and be doing, you know, this as a career so many years later, and not taking that for granted, and really respecting and appreciating some of those key figures, not even necessarily music teachers, but people that were pros in the industry and had incredible careers or incredibly talented, and even just took a beat to give me some feedback, or, you know, took an interest in something very early on when they really probably didn't have the time or didn't need to be that candid or honest with me and take time out of their schedule. So, you know, I never forgot that, and I'm trying at least to pay that forward now with a lot of that coaching, and just, you know, general mentoring, and trying to hopefully inspire everybody the way that I've been inspired, and we as a band continue to be inspired by the people around us.
For sure. Yeah. And I mean, I'm curious, have you kind of like learned any lessons yourself about like kind of this new generation of musicians that you kind of didn't expect going in?
Oh my God. Yeah. I mean, that's the other side of that coin, really, is I don't think you ever stop learning. And for me, I love the old kind of adage where the best way to learn something is to teach it. So for me, I'm like going through, and it's such a wonderful refresher course in all of these like really core values and beliefs about creativity, songwriting, and just production, and exploring that on a daily basis, but through the lens of somebody that maybe isn't aware of some of those things. It's such a cool way for me to get back in touch with the basics of a lot of those things, whether it be just music production or songwriting, or trying to think creatively and authentically about, you know, your vision as a brand, as an artist, and things like that. So yeah, I mean, looking at it now and seeing where everybody is at, I mean, everybody's always in a different place, but the realm that we live in now is this, you know, everybody's got a laptop, a home studio of some sort, even if it's just a guitar plugged into a USB, you know, interface. You don't need much to be able to get creative. You know, sometimes you don't even need that. I talk to people that are, you know, all they have half the time, or even if it's, you know, in like a, you know, an early pre-production phase with the band, I'm getting iPhone demos. You know, it's still just like the phone in the middle of a room, you know, a practice room, running through a song, right? So, but I think learning that that common thing, and that it's so easy to get so much further ahead, so quicker, and, you know, and in such a more cost effective way than it was even when I was a kid, even when I was 12 years old. And we have plenty of conversations of the gear that I, you know, we grew up on, and this is making me feel old, but you know, it's funny enough, it's because of, you know, the last 20 years, so much has happened exponentially with technology that I think it's really interesting to see how creative and how a lot of musicians, even ones that like sometimes don't let a lack of innate talent stop them, you know, like I think where there is a lot to be said for where there's a will, there's a way. And I'm, you know, learning new stuff every day about what other bands and artists are doing and trying out there and having success with. And I try to take that into my practice and ultimately pass it along if there is some other, you know, interesting thing, and trying to be as creative as possible. And, you know, some other bit of ingenuity or something that I see, it's like, hey, that's a great idea. You know, that might not be the perfect, like, you know, copy and paste for another artist, but maybe that's some really good food for thought. They can kind of awaken something else. So yeah, it's like, I never, in no way, I don't think I'd be doing any of this if I for a second pretended to like know it all, or you know, feel like there was nothing to learn out there. But, you know, I just hope that at least there's something that I can, you know, offer while I'm learning. So it's a nice back and forth transaction for sure.
And you mentioned kind of like the getting back to the basics of, you know, songwriting and creativity. And I'm curious, what are some of those guiding principles for you when it comes to songwriting and production?
Oh man. Yeah. Well, now you're really going to get me going on a tangent. This is the good stuff. This is what I love to talk about. This is what we do in a lot of these. I think first and foremost, you're looking at telling a story, right? And that seems like a no-brainer and pretty simple, but there's a lot of ways to tell a story, right? So if you look around in any medium, whether it's film, music, literature, there's so many different ways to tell a story. So I think understanding, really getting inside what the story is and maybe what the perspective is. One of my coaching sessions the other day, I mean, really got deep into the imagery and the actual time, place, setting, and moment of, you know, realization, and how that, you know, transforms a perspective, and then taking that to, you know, how do we represent those things instrumentally or musically or, you know, through a soundscape. And that's a perfect example of, you know, it's all there in the story if you just decide what the story is and what that story, you know, is trying to make someone feel, right? And then, you know, on that same token, I think it's realizing that it's about connection, right? I think art is ultimately here to try to establish a connection between people and to elicit a reaction, good, bad, ugly, sad, whatever. I think that's what really great art does. And it's definitely a subjective thing, which is also kind of nice because you can, you know, one person's trash is another person's treasure, right? Like there is no one song in the world that everybody unanimously likes, short of, you know, I don't know. There's probably one or two that get close out there, but only for so long. And then the next generation turns their back on it and says, no way, that's lame as hell. So I think that's the other real big, you know, core focus and takeaway that I try to really remember and kind of keep coming back to as far as that goes. And then ultimately, I think, you know, I think about things in two ways. I think about the underlying song, which is kind of the narrative, the emotion. And then I think about translating that to a lot of what we do, obviously, nowadays is trying to fix that on recording and make an almost larger than life version of that. Or maybe if it's not larger than life, just trying to translate the emotion of that story to a fixed medium, which is kind of difficult sometimes. If you don't know what that emotion is or what you want it to make you feel, right, or make the listener feel. So then the other side of it is really looking at listener experience, right? So you can have a great story, but if the person that's telling it is not a great storyteller, it might fall flat, and you might just put that one away or never get through it, right? Just because of the way it's being told and how it's presented. I think a lot of times there's great stories out there, but some of the authors are so incredibly creative, sometimes tend to have a style that's pretty dense, right, and tough to read. So I sometimes kind of look at that in the same way of like of production and instrumentation and things like that when you're approaching a song and songwriting and saying, okay, let's make sure it doesn't get in the way of it, you know, of what we're trying to do here. And let's make sure everything supports that song at its core and translates that emotion in the best way possible. And sometimes you just got to get out of the way and say, this song and this vocalist are doing a thing that is so raw and real. We just have to make sure that is there at the forefront, you know. That's another one that I think comes up a lot for me, and is so perfect to see, especially when starting at the beginning with a song where maybe it is just a singer sending an acoustic, you know, strumming on an acoustic with a song. I mean, a lot of Wonder Years stuff starts this way, you know, with just like playing a guitar riff on, you know, grabbing my phone real quick and doing it in the back of the van. Or, you know, maybe it's Dan writing something down and being like, I don't want to forget it. And so he's in like the hotel bathroom, you know, with his phone on the counter, just kind of like yelling and belting, you know, a line or two. And I love it because that's also a moment where you kind of just know and you learn to trust your gut and instinct that it's, speaking specifically with Wonder Years material, I think, now more than ever, I can even hear just a fragment or two, a line or two, one little riff or like a couple measures of a drum and bass groove. And I'll already get excited about seeing where I think that song could go. Maybe it decides not to go there when we collectively refine, you know, the lane that the song is between the six of us. But I think it's an amazing thing to be like, to just inherently know. When you hear such a small piece of it, it's like, that's gold. That's it. And I think it's, you know, it's cause that, it speaks to that emotion, you know, that realness, and knowing that if it immediately hits you and connects with you, there's a great chance that it's probably going to do the same thing with another human being for that kind of intangible reason. So yeah, those are probably the two big ones. I mean, there's plenty more, but you know, for another day.
Going off of that, from other stuff that I've seen you talk about as well, it seems like, you know, brainstorming and kind of following each idea to its conclusion to see where it fits or even where it doesn't fit is kind of like a philosophy of yours. And I'm curious if you could talk a little bit more about like that mindset going into it.
Yeah, no, that's a great point, I think. So sometimes the first idea is really strong and is really great. And sometimes it's not, right? But the point being that like that 12th iteration of that idea might actually be the jump off point for what becomes the biggest song of your career. So I think what you're kind of speaking to and what you're right, I do try to preach a lot, especially when it comes with songwriting and trying to get outside of anything that's, you know, that's holding you back or blocking you up or, you know, at some sort of creative stalemate, is getting in and doing the work and saying it's okay to make mistakes, to get through, to create something that the next day you wake up and you're like, this is trash, right? But you have to kind of keep going on it. And I think I just listening to, who was it? Maybe Ben Gibbard talk about how finishing ideas was really important. And even if he's halfway through a song and he knows it's not going to be something that's going to make the album, he'll just say, okay, I'll still finish it. I'm still going to finish it right now. Maybe you don't, you know, rack your brain to death about, you know, putting every last bit of energy and creative juice into that song, but you still finish it, right? Because maybe what happens is, yeah, that first two thirds of that song, you know that it wasn't really hitting you, and that you were probably just like lying to yourself because you wanted it to be something. But if you finish it, maybe there's something in that third, that last third, right? Something, maybe, you know, a little melody, a little vocal tag, a little lyrical idea that sows something else inside you that maybe you lift and start a new idea with, right? So, and you'd never really get there if you didn't finish that, you know, that part of it. And I think it's very hard. And I spent a lot of years when I was younger and still struggle with it, probably on a weekly basis to some degree, with finishing things. And, you know, I think perfectionism is a serious enemy of that, of productivity. And I think that's a perfect example. If you can finish something, the quicker you can finish something, you can get feedback not only from yourself, but also feedback from other people, right? You know, there's a lot more to be had, I think, from having a conversation with a friend and being like, man, I just wrote this song. It's not great. I'm not even sure there's anything good in it. And them saying, well, let me check it out. And you being like, okay, cool, here it is. Versus, yeah, it's not finished though. So like, you know, I'll send it over when it's finished, right? But you, in your heart of hearts and deep subconscious, no, it'll probably never be finished, so you'll probably never send it, so you'll probably never be able to get that, hey, yeah, you're right, I don't think it's, you know, really working lyrically, but that groove in the intro, there's definitely something there. And then maybe that's the little piece that brings everything, you know, to light for a new song or idea that does make the record, that does go on. So I love that you brought that up. Yeah, I wholeheartedly believe the more you can do to put yourself in a position where you can finish stuff, you know, that doesn't mean that speed is the goal, right? You know, quality is still, we're still looking for the things that resonate with us and those aha moments, but you have to do the work and be consistent at it to get to those. So,
And from like a production side of things, how do you kind of like balance that, you know, between the want to kind of follow those to the conclusion and, you know, a band that might not necessarily have all that time in the studio?
Yeah. And again, this is where some hybrid models, a lot of times, I think, are starting to really come into play. And where, like I was discussing earlier, talking about home studios and being realistic, a lot more can be done. And this is why, as someone who owns a studio, like normally you'd think, well, it doesn't behoove you to tell people to go, you know, get a home studio set up. But I think the point is that, you know, collaboration is always going to be really important to grow what you're doing and get a better final product. It's a matter of where you need that collaboration and at what point. But this is a perfect example where if you're somebody that even gets to like a basic level of literacy, even in just GarageBand or Logic, and have a little interface, then you might have time, go into the studio, get the basics, get the song structure and, you know, pre-production idea down. And then maybe you have time on your own, you know, that where you're not like burning money in the studio to sift through a bunch of ideas. And maybe you're working remotely with someone that then you can send those, you know, to a producer or to, you know, a collaborator of some sort, another songwriter, and they can listen to them. So you're not, you know, wasting 2 days to get to an idea and paying for 2 days in the studio to get to an idea that ultimately everybody feels kind of lukewarm about, right? Mm-hmm. But at the same time, if it is an idea that brings something truly to the next level or to a place that it never would have gotten, having that time is afforded to you by having the capability to play around, you know, and being able to use technology in that way, I think, can give people, so can really provide some creative opportunities to do what you're talking about and expand those ideas and give people time that they can do at home whenever they want, you know? But I think ultimately, you know, that being said, that's also a big ask, and that's not, you know, That's not me trying to put pressure on everybody saying, you're an idiot if you're not doing it all yourself. You know, I think nowadays, too, there's this allure of being such a, you know, a self-made, like, independent DIY artist. We're kind of in that era, right? And that there's so much to be said for that. And there's people out there that I look at and I'm like, I'm not actually 100% convinced you're not a robot. You know, I don't know how you do this. I'm a human being and I like to think I work hard and I feel like I couldn't accomplish like 20% of what it seems like you're doing. Turns out it's probably because they're enlisting help in some way or they're smart enough to know that they need help with certain aspects of that. But all that being said, yeah, I think you don't have to take it all on. That doesn't mean you have to do the full production, the mixing, the master, you know, but maybe a part of the process you can handle yourself. You know, I have guys that that have a recording background or, you know, have been writing and doing demoing for a while. And sometimes we'll get to the end of a project and be like, man, would love some woes and some nice like football harmonies, you know, over this chorus, or, you know, we just didn't have time to get there. And maybe that's a discussion where, hey, maybe the rest of the time in the studio this week is better served covering the rest of these guitar overdubs and, you know, playing around with a few of these ideas, because maybe you can go home and just do the like MIDI recording for the synth pad that's just the one note drone over that. You know what I mean? Maybe that's, you know, what's a better use of the time and their skill set. So there's instances where we will say, hey, can you just track the background harmonies at home? Because then at least you don't have to pay for the studio. I can fly them in, or if we need to do them again or need to change something, if you're open to going back and recutting them, then, you know, maybe that's an easier route to go. So I think there's a lot to be said for being flexible in that era and being able to do some stuff on your own.
Going off that idea of flexibility, and I guess kind of pivoting a little bit to Wonder Years stuff, I'm really curious about the writing process for Out on My Feet and Breakless, you know, which were essentially written during the quarantine. And I know the impetus for them were kind of like scrapped lyrics from Dan's archives, but I'm curious, you know, how it was kind of approached instrumentally.
Yeah, that was a fun project. And they, you know, we had the catalyst there. In the sense that we had those lyrical fragments to kind of put us back in that headspace. And we took a few looks at, you know, what would Upsides and Suburbia Us approach it with? What would be our go-to? For me, that was fun. But in the same way, we aren't those people. You know, we have lived through those periods and have all of that, I guess, you know, experience from understanding what worked, what didn't, what we liked, what we didn't. So that's refined our taste, and it's a part of the narrative of what we enjoy and like as musicians. But we've definitely, there's so much has transpired since then, so much music has been written since then, that I think there's no way to fully just go back and, you know, try to, you know, write something that is exactly that for that time and place. But I think this is about, you know, as close as we would want to get, I think, in all honesty, because I think there's always, and anybody in a band knows this, especially if you've been in a band for a while and made a lot of records and evolved your sound at all, listening to old recordings and old songs, it can be kind of a bittersweet thing. I think I've taken a bit of a nostalgic approach to it, in that I realized I did the best I could to fulfill my taste and creative outlet as an artist at that, given all factors at that time and place. So I can't, I'm not going to waste too much time going back and second guessing myself and saying, oh man, like, I wish I would have calmed down there in that verse and not tried to like play so much, you know, some instinctual things that I think only come with time. But, with these two songs specifically, it was like we could dive into that mindset, but with the tools that we have now and restraint and intuition that we have now as songwriters and as arrangers, you know. And so you talked about instrumentally, I think from a guitar standpoint, it was almost like you know, if we could go re-record Came Out Swinging, I think that would sound, not that the original version didn't do us just fine, and everybody else is okay with it as well, but like, if I would go back, that wall of sound would sound different. If, you know, I think if we were doing that now, just because it's different gear, it's a different thought process, and we have different techniques for layering stuff, you know. But that was the fun part of it. So we, you know, from that overall arrangement approach, it was taking a modern look at, you know, an old style, I guess, is the best way to put it.
And one of the things that stood out to me most about like the essays written for the box set was Dan mentioning kind of the somewhat obsession with the overarching like ebb and flow of suburbia. And I'm curious kind of how that intense attention to detail affected both those writing sessions and, you know, going forward, your future writing sessions.
So we have a number of ways of communicating different ideas when it comes to putting together cohesive flows for our albums as a whole. I think that's maybe something that is a little bit lost on in modern pop music and with, you know, the delivery methods of a lot of songs. But I think that's something that for us personally, I don't think there's a right or a wrong way, but for us, you know, as musicians, the bands that we grew up listening to and that really, you know, were the reason for us getting into the music and scene that we did, and so heavily, were all bands that put out albums that felt like albums. You know, that when you think of, you know, a song, I kind of bring this up with like old, you know, Green Day albums. It's like if you, you know, you listen to it, like you almost picture one track going in and out, and so the transitions become their own moments, you know, in and of themselves, than just like the song that you heard, you know, one after the other on a radio. So much so that I remember, like, we in Philly, there used to be a station called Y100, and I think they actually used to play those two tracks off of Dookie back to back, like one right into the other. And when I heard it, I was like, yes, this is how it should be. You know, I almost like the DJ just forgot to like stop it and play and go to the next one. But I was like, oh my God, this DJ gets it. Like, finally, you know, it's like every time that song ends, you need to hear this, it going into this next one, this next guitar part. And so I think there's something about that we always try to do and try to structure things to, again, going back to what I was talking about before, understanding the listener experience and the engagement and what that looks like on the other side, you know, and how we ultimately want it to be processed, I think. And the songs that, you know, lyrically, we'll try to tie concepts together. I've been talking a lot. I Just Want to Sell at My Funeral has been coming up a lot online. A lot of people would like to, I'm sure, maybe tune into this to hear a little bit more about things like that. But, you know, ideas like where that pulls back these central themes from the record and lyrically it moves along and reaches that point. We try to do that musically. And I've always loved looking at little themes or motifs that I can pull out that can, you know, shift the energy, can come back, and where to use those moments. I think maybe a couple records ago, maybe on Greatest Gem was the record that I think we started really maybe realizing some of the things that we'd learned about what worked really well with the suburbia track listing, in that we were shooting for moments, you know, and thinking it that way. And, you know, a moment didn't need to be, hey, how hard can I hit somebody over the head with three guitars and a kick drum? You know, it was maybe a little bit more of, well, a moment can also be when the dynamics just drop out to the floor and it's nothing but a vocal, right? And I think suburbia, you know, because of that, because it has, it almost works in a three movement sense, we tried to do that and weave this commonality throughout it, not only with the storyline, but also, you know, musically, and those, you know, the suburbia I've given you on now, nothing, that was a a candid choice for us to put those all in a triple meter, right? So that they uniquely felt like that all through, you know, one by one. So when you're getting to it, even if you that wasn't the first thing you were thinking about it, it is a decided shift in cadence with each one of those that kind of pulls through to the end as well. So, you know, we've pulled out the whiteboards. We love whiteboards. We will not write without them anymore. It looks like a high school football locker room with just like, you know, zigzags and lines. And even as crazy as kind of visualizing the energy in terms of like graph form, even talking about a song, you know, it's like, it's something so simple and rudimentary, but I think it really gets to the heart of maybe someone trying to pitch an idea for a song. If you immediately say, okay, cool. So like it starts out there and then builds all the way like that, or it kind of just goes like this and then hops down and then goes like this and then hops down, right? You can immediately digest and start to extrapolate what the song structure and arrangement and components might feel like for that. So we do that on a micro level, you know, even with certain sections of a song, and then pull it out to a full song. And then even talking about it when it gets to track listing time, that's, you know, that's a component for how we want it to flow and why. And, you know, we're kind of all in on the conversation when it comes to that and trying to marry that with.
I think I sometimes forget kind of just how big of a moment Suburbia was for the Wonder Years, because the Upsides was like my entry point to the band. And then I have like a lot of really specific memories tied to the Greatest Generation. But I mean, like for the GK tour, you're selling out shows left and right, and, you know, added a bunch of those matinee shows where you played the album in full. And, you know, the writing sessions were just this crazy whirlwind, you know, less than a year after the release of the Upsides, with maybe 10 weeks off in between, and you know, recording it that quickly. I'm curious, what are kind of some of the moments that stand out the most to you from that time period?
Yeah, it was wild. And what's funny is with the anniversary re-release that we just put out of both of those albums, kind of going back and realizing, oh my god, they came out like so, you know, so close together. And that time period for us, so much was happening. And yeah, we were really hitting the pavement hard and touring hard. So it was, you know, it was brutal, but in the best way, you know, in a way where all of us were really excited, you know, maybe a little apprehensive, starting to like toy with, you know, or grapple with the idea of like expectation kind of coming into play now. You know, you put out a record and you're like, everybody loves it. It's like, then you start to hear things like, well, there's no way they can top that record. And you're like, wait, I never even thought that we would get to a point where anybody would care about a record, you know, let alone like people being like, there's no way like they'll ever do anything better. It's like, it's, you know, like, I feel like it's just, we're kind of just getting going here. Like, give us a chance. But then, you know, so it's almost this becomes this self-imposed pressure that we start to, you know, try to avoid and leave, but also are very grateful to have the opportunity for that. And, you know, try our best to keep our heads on straight, you know, and put out a great record that also, you know, doesn't feel rushed, but felt like it had the same weight, if not more weight, as, you know, what we tried to convey and put across with Upsides, which was, you know, the first full length album that we as a band kind of got behind and brought some more meaningful themes to the surface for us as of. So yeah, I mean, it was crazy. I, you know, down to the practice spaces, I get a lot of Dan is actually much better in terms of a uncanny photographic memory when it comes to dates and things like that. But I will say that's definitely that period as a whole, from the first time, I think shortly thereafter, you know, the first time we ended up doing Warped Tour, we were playing a lot of songs off of that record, obviously. You know, I just was talking about that recently and what that is like and was like, and such a memorable thing. And I think it all kind of encapsulates that realization where that record, when Suburbia came out specifically, we were like, oh shit, we might be doing this for a little bit here, guys. You know, when I think even up until like when Upsize was coming out, we felt the excitement. We knew the release shows were really intense for us for that record. And, you know, seeing a local fan base kind of, you know, really explode and starting to realize, oh, we can. This, there's a fire here that we can maybe feed a little bit, but I think Suburbia was probably the one, at least for me, that I realized, you know, in no way were we like resting on our laurels. It almost felt like, wait, something's happening. We gotta hit the gas now, and kind of didn't look back for 5 or 6 years, honestly, like through Greatest Gen and No Closer. You know, it almost seems like they kind of all strung together. But yeah, man, I was just looking at footage of that GK tour, and that came up, and the vinyl that we did for it was awesome, and that's one of my favorites still to this day. We're incredible. We're some of my favorite, and I think that might have been the back-to-back tour where, well, don't quote me on this. I didn't say this, but where we may have just stayed overnight at one of my favorite venues growing up, and that was an odd experience, hanging out there overnight while no one else was around. That was an interesting meet, but yeah, it was cool. It was really neat, and so grateful that we got to have those experiences, and so grateful that we got to kind of reshare some of them and retell them with the way the book came together for the anniversary box set. So we love doing that, and it was so cool to see everybody's reaction and get everybody's takes and see how it hit them.
It's interesting to me that you're in sort of a similar situation that you were after Suburbia came out going into the Greatest Generation, where it's like you have two albums with a sort of a newer sound, a different sound. And then you're kind of, you know, the Greatest Generation kind of capped off a lot of sonic and lyrical themes. And I'm curious, does it kind of feel like you're in a similar transition point for the band?
You know, I think the band in one way or the other has always been in a transitional point. I think that's one of the things that's kind of mirrored our process has been the way we've been growing as people and the way life doesn't stop for the people that listen to our band as well. And I think that's a lot of the shared commonality in life experience, or, you know, relating to the world and things that are happening and ongoing. So in that way, we've always been in a transitional period. But yes, like Greatest Gen did in some ways maybe put a hypothetical pin in some of those things. Well, that wasn't necessarily our intent when we set out, you know, putting out the first album. It did kind of happen that way. But I think now it's an interesting point where we've realized that for all the things that we've done and all the things that we've tried that I'm incredibly proud of, I think we feel really grateful that we have the opportunity to kind of go anywhere. Are we going to make a Nine Inch Nails record? No. You know, it's no great surprise. I think there will always be a part of us that's attached to playing loud, high energy punk rock that hits you with what we hope are very meaningful and candid lyrics, right? So I think in a way, we realize maybe with No Closer to Heaven, but really on Sister Cities that allowed us to, you know, to branch out and try a few things, that a Wonder Years song and a Wonder Years record is just going to be the sum of the six of us and wherever that collectively decides to take a song that it feels good. But it's always going to have those elements at its core, you know. It's always going to have that voice. It's always going to have that character. And I think it's always going to have that perspective and that kind of attitude to it, even if it's not a super fast, you know, punk rock song off Suburbia, right? So, you know, I don't know, but all I can say is we really did have a lot of fun doing those two new songs and doing those two new songs in that style. So I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, when we start to shift into deciding what songs are going to comprise a new release or what songs we'll, you know, we'll put forth into the world next, that some that that share a good bit of similarity to the color and concept of those show up there. I wouldn't be surprised at all. And that's probably about as much as I can say for sure right now.
Gotcha. Yeah, I love that you said that it's kind of like a sum of the six of you, and how you said the band is kind of like always in a transition, because I feel like it's kind of the perfect combination of musically, you're very true to yourselves. And then like on the, I guess, business side of things, for lack of a better word, it's like you're probably one of the best bands that I know at like fan service, at like giving the fans these unique experiences that they want, you know, whether it's the VIP sessions that you've done, or the box set that you did, or the Sundrance Pavement Society. Can you talk a little bit about like that side of things, and, you know, how you approach that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's really powerful to hear you say that. And we do put a lot of time and energy into that exact aspect of what we do as a band. I think when we first started this band, you know, like a handful of people that, you know, those first shows were like, oh shit, they know our lyrics. Like, okay, well, I guess we better not play horribly then. You know, talking about the, you know, the disappointment or expectation factor. And I think that's always kind of followed us, where we've always seen ourselves as trying to over deliver in some way. You know, I think that was strung through when we played live. We always wanted to try to make an impact. It's very tough when you're a band at the bottom of a bill on a tour where where people only want to see the headliner. You have to work, you feel like you have to work extra hard to give yourself the best chance of putting something forth that they'll remember, that they'll take away with them, right? And so for us, it was, okay, go as hard as we can. We get a half an hour. We're going to use that half an hour to kill ourselves and leave it all out on the stage, right? So that was us trying to over-deliver. And sometimes, you know, that maybe yielded some positive results, and sometimes it didn't, right? I think in the same way, when it comes to now realizing that we've been able to have this career that's lasted going on two decades now, that it's because in fact of all of the support from those fans, that some of whom have been there since, you know, the first inception of the band, you know, and have been supportive through everything, that has given us the opportunity to continue making music, that we never want to take that for granted, right? Because that is, you know, at the end of the day, yes. So it is being in a band with my friends that then also turned into us running a business and trying to figure out how to continue to make a living with the goal of being able to make more music. So it's really just like, it is a way for us to try to allow ourselves to continue always putting new things out for the people that have already supported us in what we've put out. So we always, that's honestly always where our focus tends to lie and tends to land, and the compass that I think tries to guide us through every album cycle, every new release, really anything from the ground up that we think about when we're thinking about merch designs. It's like what would our fans, what have they been asking for, right? What do we think they would really enjoy? What do we think they haven't seen that would be really unique and really special for them? And how can we do it? You mentioned the Sundrance Pavement Society. That was, you know, a unique idea that we wanted to experiment with, because we knew that, yeah, it's probably not going to be for everybody, but the people that were really close to the family and close to our heart, we thought it could be a really neat opportunity to give them something, you know, really special and a memorable year in that way. And you know, I think there were pros and cons to everything, but I think that showed a lot of us realizing that, you know, our core fan base is, I feel like every band says this, but I don't care, I'm gonna say it because it really is true. Our fans are some of the sweetest, most genuine people that any band could ask for. And I'll kind of say this, I've heard people say over the years, and I think it's really true, that you don't always get to choose your fans, right? You can start out and say, I want like what I think a fan of this band would look like, and be like, that's who I want to hang out with, right? And then all of a sudden, like, the song gets picked up on like modern rock radio, and then you have guys in Nickelback t-shirts coming to your show, and you're like, wait, where are we? Like, what, you know, what happened? What did we do? But you're also like, well, but we're selling like 5,000 tickets a night, so I guess that's also good. Or then you're like that weird band where everybody comes and sits through like a weird hour just to hear the one radio single, you know? And I think, you know, given the chance and going back, I would not have the career that we've had play out any other way, because it's taught us a lot of really important lessons. And one of them is exactly that always trying to look at how we can over deliver and really show the people that give us this livelihood how much we really do care. Because I think sometimes even words get lost and or they're said so much that they start to lose their meaning and impact. But I think that's ultimately what we hope, is that through the actions that we take in trying to curate sets, do really interesting VIP experiences, or just let people know in really subtle ways that they've given us a gift that we can't possibly forget, and trying to pay it back, which also I think in a lot of ways goes back to what we were talking about with even you know, the coaching or the mentoring through the studio. I think that's part of me where I'm just like, hey, I'm lucky enough to have been doing this for long enough to, as it turns out, learn some shit, and it's because I had people that were there to be like, hey, you should really think about this, or you're not doing this, you probably want to work on that, right? And give me that feedback. So that's also a way of, like, even for fans, but also younger musicians that are or aren't Wonder Years fans, I think that's a really important way that also for me personally, we can kind of give that advice and pay it forward.
For sure. Yeah, I think that's the perfect kind of knot to tie on the conversation. So I'll wrap up with the question that I end every episode with, which is just by asking for a piece of advice or something you've been thinking about lately, whether it's, you know, music or life in general, just something that you would like to share.
Oh, man. Yeah. You know, I'll probably say this, because I feel like this in some way ties into a piece of whether it's songwriting or creativity or in general looking forward to anything that I think you want to do with your life or trying to see where it's going and trying to accomplish anything. I think observation is a really huge thing. And I've been kind of ruminating on this thought and idea a lot recently. And knowing, having a plan is really good. And I think there's a lot of merit to being able to sketch out a playbook for where you want to go. And I definitely think that's necessary. But I think there's also a really valuable opportunity in observing where life and the things around you are going and seeing what kind of opportunities that might be presenting that maybe you're missing. I've probably missed tons. I'm sure everybody does. That's also kind of part of it, is having that, that hindsight, idea creep in from time to time. But I think that's for me, the idea of just trying to be mindful and observe the things around you. I mean, if you're a songwriter, there's your story, there are your songs. It's all around you, right? You know, maybe get out of your head a little bit and go observe the people, the places, the ideas, the phenomenons around you. And if you're us, if you're a band and you're trying to continue doing it for another 20 years, observe the people that are supporting you, observe the things that are working that you like doing, and observe what's working and what's not, you know, and observe the, you know, the scene and industry around you to try and figure out how to make that a reality. So I that's probably, you know, it boils down to really just one word, but it's more or less being mindful, I think, in that sense. That's really important, music or otherwise, and that I've been trying to hold pretty closely as a big part of my practice recently. So yeah, that's, if you're looking for advice, that's what I guess I would say. Go forth and try to be observant in your day-to-day life and where it might be trying to guide you.
For this show, I've talked to Dan Campbell, Matt Brash, and now Casey Cavalier to make it a Wonder Years hat trick. Thanks so much to Casey for taking the time to talk and for all his work on both sides of the music spectrum. This one was truly a blast, so I hope you found it exciting too.
For the first time, I can say I'll talk to you super soon. Don't forget to check back on Thursday for yet another candid conversation on music. With touring still off the table for the foreseeable future, I want to do everything in my power to spread the word on music of the artists I believe in. I'm so glad to have you along for the ride. Fly on the Call is brought to you by Sound Talent Media. A special thank you, as always, to The Alternative for helping to promote the show, Kaylin West of Tiny Stills for the theme song, and Michaela Jane Palermo for the artwork. You can keep up to date by subscribing to the podcast and following the show on Twitter and Instagram at Fly on the Call Pod. Feel free to email any questions, comments, or other feedback to me at flyonthecallpod@gmail.com. Word of mouth is such an important thing in the DIY music world. Shout about what you love as loudly as possible, as often as possible. Fly on the call.
Hello, everybody. I'm Bruce.
And I'm Nolan, and this is the Corner of Gray Street podcast. As longtime Dave Matthews Band fans, we set out to create a podcast to dive deep into the past, present, and future of DMB.
Not only do we recap and review shows within an ongoing tour, but we revisit past shows from throughout the band's history, conduct interviews with a wide variety of guests with ties to DMB, and create unique and exclusive content like our Concerts on the Corner series.
Whether you're a fan of the band or just a fan of great music, we think you'll find something you'll enjoy. We can't wait to see you on the Corner of Gray Street.